Deborah Schroth, who I'm sure hopefully most of you were have listened. If you weren't able to join us for the call last month, have listened to it by now on the website. If you have not done that, please remember to do that. These calls are mandatory. Deborah is an attorney with Florida Legal Services in Jacksonville, and she's been working on independent living issues for a long time. I don't know how many years, Deborah, but a while. And she's by far the most knowledgeable child advocate on this specific issue in Florida. And if there's ever an independent living issue that comes up, everyone always says, well, ask Deborah, she'll know. So I encourage you, I know she'll take questions at the end, so I encourage you to please, jot down your questions as she's going through the training so that you'll have the opportunity to address them with her at the end of the training. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Deborah.
Thank you, Mary Kay. And thank you all for coming back again today for hopefully will be the ending of this particular discussion. One of the things that we talked about last month that I wanted to follow up on was we had a brief colloquy among a few of us about whether a youth who is coming out of a DJJ placement on his or her 18th birthday qualifies for the Road to Independence program. And I naively, perhaps, believe that they do, and the reason I believe that is based on the rule rather than the statute. So in the materials, I've referenced the particular rule, and what it says is that the youth must be or have been in the legal and or physical custody of the department at the time of his or her 18th birthday. Because it separates out legal custody from physical custody, I think the argument can be made that the rule intends something specific. And part of the reason and why I say I naively believe this is because when the department initially drafted that rule and did the first workshopping, I commented to them by thanking them for now making it clear that youth coming out of DJJ on their 18th birthday would qualify for RTI, because there had been a lot of problems with that prior to the rule being drafted. Now, there's nothing in writing where the department says that that is the case, but I still believe that that's what it means. Now, then the problem becomes, well, can you show that a child is in the legal custody of DCF? And the law gets really murky about custody of minors, legal custody of minors. And so you need to examine, if you're going to do a legal analysis of this, you need to examine whether children are under the complete control of DJJ or even Department of Corrections who are under the age of 18, regardless of where they are. And the answer is no, although the punishment overlay takes away the day-to-day control from the families. The parent remains responsible for the child. If the child is in DJJ, there is a likelihood that they will be charged the cost of providing that care. And the parent also is still the one who consents to any non-emergency surgery and to other types of issues concerning the child. So I think the argument can still be made that the child is in the legal custody of the department, regardless of where they're physically located. Now, if that comes up for any of the youth that you're working with, the best thing to do is ensure that the youth completes an application. And for anybody who ever has done or seen any public benefits work, you'll see that this is always a trick of the bureaucracy, is to tell somebody, oh, you don't qualify, and then they walk away. And if they walk away, they have no further rights. But the youth has the right to complete and submit an application. By doing that, the youth then will get a notice of denial, and that notice of denial can then be appealed. I will reiterate this towards the end of the call when I talk about the appellate process, just so that you have some idea of what that is. But in this kind of an instance, if you have this kind of a youth with this particular problem, that youth needs an attorney to handle the appeal. And frankly, I wouldn't mind being one of the lawyers tasked with representing a youth with this particular issue. And then we can pull together a group of people statewide who would be willing to do an amicus brief if we lost and went up to a district court of appeal. So that takes care of a question that arose in the last call. And I wanted to start today because the last time I went over changes in the law and some other issues, I wanted to start with going through the various categories of help for kids who are coming out of foster care at the age of 18. And they get various things. They are entitled to, and this is an entitlement, the tuition and fee exemption. They're entitled to staying in the foster home, but they have to pay for that. They're eligible for the Road to Independence program. They're eligible for transitional support, and they're eligible for aftercare. Those independent living programs are not entitlements, however. Again, if you have not done any type of public benefits work, the word entitlement might be a mystery to you. What an entitlement is a program that the government must provide for you if you meet the requirements. A non-entitlement program is the government must give you those program benefits if you meet the requirements and if the government has appropriated sufficient money. So that's the difference. A non-entitlement means if the agency's run out of money, too bad for you. So let me now talk about these in some detail. The tuition and fee exemption, and it's an exemption rather than a waiver, and that's important because there's nothing that the youth has to do other than present proof of their entitlement to this tuition and fee exemption. I've got the statutory citation in the materials. They have to go to the community-based care agency, the independent living coordinator, to get something that shows how they meet those requirements. Mary Kay, I'm not certain where you are in the rules on having the special court order, if we're anywhere, and I don't even remember where I am with you on that, but whether there is going to be a form order for the court to enter when a youth exits foster care that simply says these are all of the things that the youth has done that show the requirements for the tuition and fee exemption. So it would say the youth was in foster care on his or her 18th birthday, the youth spent, you know, a minimum of 6 months in foster care during the youth's life, and whatever else is necessary. But in any event, the youth has to produce some documents that show that they meet those requirements, and then they get the tuition and fee exemption. Of course, the state of Florida can only give that exemption for state-run schools. So if a student wants to go to Stetson University, for example, which is a private school, or if they wanted to go to a vocational or technical school that's not run by the state of Florida or one of its governmental subsidiaries, then there is no fee exemption or tuition exemption because Florida doesn't have the authority to do that. And there's no money appropriated with this. It simply is you go to a state-run school and you don't pay any tuition and you don't have to pay any fees, including lab fees. This year, the law changed, it'll be effective on the first Sunday, I guess, that a child who is still in foster care, if you have somebody in foster care who actually is able to go to college now, perhaps they either graduated from high school early or they left school and got a GED early, if they then want to attend college, they can do so and they will now qualify for the tuition and fee exemption. That was just a little quirk in the law that's now been fixed. If you are in foster care or you qualify because you graduated from the foster care system, there's no limitation on how long you get the tuition and fee exemption. Now, if too many students stretch it out over too many years, we might see another statutory change. But right now, there's no limit on the length of time. And that sometimes is misunderstood by the CBCs. To exempt yourself from fees, you can go to school just one class, any kind of part-time. You don't have to go to school full-time. Whatever you do in attending school, you don't pay tuition and fees. There are some other categories of youth that this tuition and fee exemption applies to, and it's set out in the materials. It's the only benefit that applies to a student who is in relative custody, pursuant to Section 39.5085, if they're in relative custody at age 18. It's the only benefit you get when you turn 18 for having gone into relative custody rather than foster care. If you meet the qualifications for this exemption by being an adopted student, a student in relative custody, then there is a time limit on the benefits that you get, and it's four calendar years. So for those two categories of students, if they're serious about wanting to get a four-year degree and they want to do it without paying tuition, they need to do it full-time calendar years because their exemption qualification ends after four calendar years from graduation from high school. Now, the one nice thing about it is that they don't have to have graduated from high school at or about age 18. If you have somebody that meets these requirements, they could go back to college, for example, when they turn 20, and then if they're in this limited category, they still only have four calendar years. But if they haven't used it all up, they can start it from whenever they graduate from high school. You might see kids who don't get their GEDs until they're 19, 20, 21 years old, and then if they're in this limited category, they still have 4 years from the date they graduate from high school or get that GED. Another benefit that isn't used very much for a number of reasons is that any youth aging out of foster care who's eligible for any one of the three independent living programs may choose to remain in his or her family foster home or group home, or the youth may choose to move to a different licensed family home or group home, and the agency has to help them find a home. The problem is there aren't that many homes that exist, family foster homes that exist for teenagers anyway, and if a kid wants to remain in or go to a group home, many of the group homes have board rates that are really high. The youth has to pay to live there. The department has no obligation to pay for the youth to live in the foster home. It's useful for kids in family foster homes who turn 18 during a school year, especially if they're still in school, so that that way they can stay in their home school without having the problems of trying to figure out now a bus route to take them to school, or the school system saying, oh, you have to leave and you have to go to another school now, which is usually guaranteed that the youth is going to end up dropping out. I actually had that happen to a young lady I was representing. She was amazingly on track to graduate from high school, even though she had a baby. But when in April of last year she aged out and she couldn't stay in the group home where she was because the group home board rate is over $5,000 a month, and the group home was not willing to waive that for even 6 weeks for her. You can always negotiate with the group home, though, or help the youth negotiate with the family foster home as to how much money they're going to have to pay to stay there. The benefit to the foster parents is that the youth does not count as a foster child for licensing purposes, so the foster family is not responsible for the child, but that adult now staying in their home doesn't count towards the cap, whatever cap they have on their particular foster care license. Another benefit is transitional support services. This is one of the specific independent living benefits. The next three are the independent living program benefits. And there was a myth about transitional support before the rule was enacted. It was a policy that the department had adopted, but not through rulemaking. And it was that there was a maximum of $5,000 that a youth could receive in a fiscal year. And the other thing that the department did was, instead of looking at the statute and making an independent judgment as to how much money a youth needed, they simply took the $5,000 and divided it by 12. So if you qualified for transitional support, you simply got the $412 or $4.6 or whatever it was a month, whether you asked for less than that or not. Well, that's no longer applicable. That was one of the things that the department did concede was not in the statute, and therefore they couldn't require it by rule. What the rule does do, though, is it says that we will only give you this money for periods of 3 months.
This one just moved to the afternoon.
Transitional support is a good program for anyone who is going to school part-time rather than full-time so that they don't qualify for Road to Independence. At least they can try to get some money. at the end of every three-month period, if the services that are being provided, including money, remain vital for the youth to achieve self-sufficiency, the youth can reapply for the services. The services will be terminated any time they are determined to no longer be critical to the youth's own efforts to achieve self-sufficiency and develop a personal support system. Now, in looking at the goals that the youth has to put in, there will be a written transitional case plan, and it will have goals in there. The agency, in the past, some agencies have declined to renew an application because the youth didn't complete the tasks in the goal. Well, that's not what the statute says, and I actually took one of those cases up on appeal. Unfortunately, the Office of Appeal Hearings are all unreported, so it's hard to rely on precedent, which is why I'm giving you the DCF case number on the appeal here, that there is a determination that the rule means what it says and the statute means what it says, and that the youth has to make progress towards the completion of the task, but the youth doesn't necessarily have to accomplish the task. The amount of that benefit is supposed to be calculated based on the need that the youth demonstrates for help. Another financial program is aftercare support services. There was two myths surrounding that. One was that there was a cap of $1,000 in a fiscal year that a youth could get. That's not true. It's never been in the statute, so there is no cap. In many parts of the state, the CBCs were saying that you could only get aftercare support services if they were needed to prevent homelessness. That was, again, misreading the statute. The statute says that when a youth applies for aftercare support services in order to prevent homelessness, that application is to be expedited. Obviously, it doesn't do you any good if you need money to pay the rent or else you're going to be evicted if they take all the time in the world to process that application so you're on the street when they say, oh, you're approved. But that service is not limited to preventing homelessness. This is the one and only independent living program that any youth who is in foster care on the age of 18 or in the custody of the department at the age of 18 can access. That means if you were in care for one day, the day of your birthday, you qualify for aftercare support. Now, the downside to that is that when finances get tight, aftercare is the first one of the programs that is just kind of cut out by the CBCs. Remember, I said that these are not entitlements, so once they hit a budget crunch, they are justified in saying, well, you are categorically qualified, but we have no more money. Now, the youth can still appeal that decision, but if indeed there is no more money, it's going to be difficult for the youth to prevail because it's not an entitlement program. And the problem comes in towards the end of a fiscal year. You know, right now, I have not heard anything from anybody around the state as to where the agencies are, but we're a few days away from the end of the 06-07 fiscal year, and I would not be surprised if any applications that are being made right now are either denied temporarily or the agencies are trying to put them off until the 1st of July. So that's an issue to be sensitive to. The premier independent living program is the Road to Independence. In addition to the general qualifications, you must be a Florida resident. Now, I've had some folks worry that, well, if I go to school outside of Florida, does that cut me out? Well, no, it doesn't, because you can retain your Florida residency even though you go to school outside the state of Florida. For the initial award, you have to be no older than 20 years old. Once you get an award, however, prior to the age of 20, you can renew it up to your 23rd birthday. And then there is a host of statutory educational institutions that you have to attend. Almost any post-secondary institution is going to qualify. High school qualifies. GED programs qualify. The monthly amount of this grant is maxed out at $892 a month, but it's based upon the student's need, determined by a need assessment. The need assessment was something that was the source of litigation, and we fought long and hard with the department to get a need assessment that honored the financial rules that's in another federal law, which is a federal financial aid law. And we finally got that in place. I've not had any feedback from people, though, as to how the needs assessments are going. If you're still in high school, the needs assessment is pretty easy. Your need is automatically calculated at the maximum of $892 a month. However, if you have special needs, then you can have the amount of that need added in, and then the student can ask for additional financial help from either transitional support services, or aftercare support services. So that's why if you have a special need, it is important to put it in there. So for example, if you've got a student who's taking higher level math classes and they're told they need a graphing calculator, well, that calculator, the student has to buy it. The schools don't provide them. And so that need can get added in, and they may be able to get a little bit more help for that from transitional or aftercare programs. If you are post-secondary, and it can be either college or it can be a vocational or a vocational program, training program, technical program, those all qualify. The needs assessment now gets very complicated. It's complicated because there is an academic year needs assessment and then there is a second summer needs assessment, with summer being defined as whatever the break period is that normal classes are held. So if you go to a school that has a summer A and a summer B program, both A and B summer, those months comprise the summer needs assessment. All of the needs assessment forms are referenced in the rules, and they are all available on the DCF website. If you go to it and you go to publications, and then you look for, they have an e-forms publication list on their website. You have to know what the name of it is. Unfortunately, they don't index them by form number. They index them by form name. But all of those forms are available, or you can go to the CBC, talk to the independent living coordinator, and you can get a copy of them. When the IL coordinators complete them, they do it online, and the calculations are done automatically for them by computer. In addition to having a victory of your needs assessment and then a separate summer needs assessment, it's very complicated to explain why that's necessary. We also had a victory that the cost of attendance of going to the school now specifically includes all the expenses that are permitted by the Higher Education Act, and it's, I think, of 1965 or something. Now, where this comes into play is that under federal law, and keep in mind that the bulk of 80% of the money that goes into the Road to Independence program comes from the federal government. There's a 20% state match that's required, but most of the funds come from the Chafee law, and so those are federal funds, and so we've got to follow federal rules. You can't get financial aid or Chafee aid that exceeds your cost of attending college. For example, the government is not in the business of giving you money to go to spring break in Cancun, but the government is willing to give you the actual cost of your attending college in financial aid if you qualify for it. So those are the rules that the state has to follow. The COA, or cost of attendance, can also be very confusing. If you look at a university website, let's say you've got a student in junior or senior year, and your own child is trying to figure out where to go to college, one of the important things to know is, one, is my child going to meet the general requirements? But secondly, if my child does, can I afford it? And so the universities and colleges will post an average cost of attendance. And they'll usually break the average down for three different types of students. One will be a student who lives on campus in the dormitory. Another will be a student who lives off campus but still lives away from home. And the third will be for students who live at home. But those are average. They usually use a liberal arts degree, and especially when you're calculating books and fees, it makes a very big difference between whether you're attending school and majoring in liberal arts or whether you're majoring in math or science or engineering, because the cost of science and math textbooks is sky high. Many of the schools will give an average book cost, for example, of $600 a year. If you're majoring in a hard science, math, or engineering, your book costs are likely to be over $700 each semester that you're in school if you're buying new books. And frankly, used books, unless you buy them online and take a risk of nobody sending them to you after you've paid, you go to the bookstore and buy used books, and they're not it's not much of a difference in cost. So even if you buy the books used, you're going to have higher costs than what shows up in the COA. There's other things that the federal government allows to go into this COA or cost of attendance, and that will be child care expenses. So if one of the youth who is applying for Road to Independence money has a child that he or she has custody of, they're allowed to include their child care expenses during the hours that they have to go to school, as well as a certain length of time for studying purposes. And that is clearly not going to be in the COA that the university posts on its website. Now, the department and the agencies can't do anything about the COA. So a student who has any of these special expenses needs to go to their student finance office and make sure that their cost of attendance is computed under the Higher Education Act using their own costs. If the school won't do that, then you need to get that student to an attorney, or you can do it, but you're going to be dealing directly with the school, and you're going to be looking at the Higher Education Act of 1965 in making sure the student is able to get a higher COA. So, and again, the reason that that's important is because that sets out your maximum need. You can't get any more than $892 a month, but if your need is greater than that, then your income or any other scholarships that you get in subtracting out from your need, you can still have a high need so that even with other scholarships, you can still get the maximum. Or even if you're working, you can still get the maximum. So that's why it's important. If a student's going to get the maximum on an average COA and they don't need any other money, then it's not nearly as important. But especially for kids who have high transportation costs, high book costs, or child care expenses, it is important. Now, I also said that there's a difference between school year expenses and summer expenses. In the summer, the department wants to make sure that the student works or goes to school. So the summer needs assessment will look at the student's need for the summer based on whatever educational expenses they have if they're in school and their living expenses. If a student needs to be an intern somewhere where they're working for free, but it advances their position in college, then that will count as attending summer school. If you're not doing some sort of an internship or going to school, going to classes, then you are expected to work. However, the department agreed with us that in some communities in Florida, it's not easy for students to get work only in the summertime. And so if a student can't find a job, even after diligently looking for a job, they can still get assistance over the summertime. So that, again, is important to know. If they do find a job, then they have to document that within 7 days. If they don't have a job, if they're not looking for a job, if you have a student who says, oh, I want to be just like, you know, my friend who lives at home with their mom and dad lets them sit at home all summer long doing nothing, that student's going to get cut off from any aid, but only for the summertime. As soon as they go back to school, they'll get aid again. I wanted to go over some miscellaneous provisions with you. The applications for services. the rule requires that the youth all have access to the physical paper applications for the independent living program. The reason that the rule requires that is because in some situations, the agencies would say, the IL coordinators would say, you know, I don't think you meet the requirements, so I'm not going to sit here on the computer and fill out an application with you. Well, that's wrong. As I said before, that's a very bureaucratic response, and it's an improper response. So even if the IL coordinator believes the youth isn't eligible and therefore doesn't want to take his or her time to go through the application, the youth has to be given the opportunity to complete the application and submit it. And again, that's crucial. If you submit an application, then whatever action the agency takes on that application is appealable. But if the youth walks away and says, oh, they say I'm not qualified, then there is no opportunity for you to file any type of an appeal. And that goes along also with the fact that the applications not only have to be submitted, but they have to be processed or acted upon. And I've set forth the rules and the materials that say that the applications have to be available and acted upon. So what happens if a youth applies for one of these post-18 independent living program benefits and they are denied? Well, the agency, first of all, is required to provide a written notice of its action on any application. Now, in the past, when before the rule was adopted and when the manual, the department had published a manual for the CBCs to use, the manual only said that the department had to submit a written notice to the youth if they denied the application or if they were terminating benefits. And then many of the agencies took denial to mean, I'm giving you nothing, when in fact, under constitutional law as applied to administrative procedures, state action, if somebody asks for X and they're told, we're going to give you Y, that's at best a partial denial, and therefore you still have the opportunity to appeal that. So for example, a youth applies for Road to Independence and they're given $700 a month as their monthly benefit. Well, some agencies would say the application was for Road to Independence, you're getting Road to Independence, we didn't deny you anything. In fact, that student has the right to appeal the benefit amount. They asked for the full amount. Everybody asks for the full amount. You don't ask for less. So you can appeal the way the agency did the calculation. You can appeal what went into the calculation. If you say, my COA says I have these additional expenses because I have a child or because I'm in the nursing program and I have to buy scrubs and a blood pressure cuff and a stethoscope and you won't include that, that's subject to appeal. Anything that's not a full and complete grant of whatever it is you've applied for gives rise to the right to file an appeal. Now, I'm talking about administrative procedures and appealing agency action. However, the department under Florida's APA in Chapter 120 is exempt in certain instances, not all, but in certain instances, from sending appeals to DOA, the Department of Appeal Hearings, which is a separate agency where you have your hearing heard by an administrative law judge. DCF is one of the agencies that has some exemptions from that, and the independent living program falls within those exemptions. It's because it's a benefit program that it is administering, and therefore they hold what they call a fair hearing. And their fair hearings are heard by hearing officers. Hearing officers are employees of the Department of Children and Families. They work in the Auditor General's office. But it's DCF employees that are overseeing action by another DCF contractor. And that's an interesting thing to note by my saying that, is that, in fact, when these cases go up on appeal, the respondent is not the community-based care agency, but rather the respondent is the Department of Children and Families. What makes these hearings even more frustrating at times is the fact that DCF has contracted with the Attorney General's office to represent DCF in these hearings. The AG's office, the particular attorneys that are in the administrative division, they don't particularly like going to these hearings. There's no panache to going to a fair hearing rather than going in front of an ALJ. And frankly, I'm not sure that many of the AG lawyers who handle these appeals have taken a lot of time to learn the program. Complicating the matter is their client is DCF, and yet the actual actor is the CBC. So these hearings can be very frustrating in terms of discovery, in terms of trying to reach a settlement in the case, because the lawyer talks to DCF, but the person who has to fork over the money or make a change in its procedure is the CBC. So it's all very bizarre. I'm trying to get the department now to agree to handle these in-house through its own general counsel's office. They said that they had initially anticipated when the rule was drafted that there would be a huge number of appeals, and apparently not many youth are appealing any of the adverse decisions against them, so that I think DCF might be willing to take back their own representation, which would help tremendously. The process for filing an appeal is that, first of all, the agency has to give the youth a written notice of how it's acting on the youth's application. If there never is a written notice, if there's just a verbal, oh, you don't qualify, or oh, you qualify, but we're only going to give you X amount, then somebody ought to help that youth intervene with the department to be given a written notice. The written notice is what triggers the whole right to appeal. Now, at some point, no action equals action, and at some point, a youth can demand, through filing a request for an appeal anyway, can demand to have an appeal hearing based on no action at all. If you have a youth who's no older than 19 and you have extended court jurisdiction, I think that if the department is not, the agency rather, is not meeting the requirements to accept applications, act on applications, and respond with written notice within the deadlines that are contained in the rules, going to the court on that youth's behalf or coaching the youth in how to go to the judge, him or herself, is probably a good way to handle it. I think it's a more direct way to make sure that the agency does what it's supposed to do. For anybody over 19, however, that obviously is not an option, and everything has to be handled by an administrative proceeding. Also, even if you have extended court jurisdiction, I'm not so certain that the youth has any right to go to the circuit court judge and say, "Judge, I applied for road to independence and was denied. You tell them to give it to me." I don't think the circuit court has the authority to do that. I might be wrong, but I'm fairly certain legally that it has to go through this administrative process. So the youth receives a written denial, and then the youth has to request an appeal. The youth can request an appeal orally, but especially if the crux of the appeal is an interpretation of the law, I would not recommend it. First of all, there's always proof problems. If you have a less than diligent caseworker, sometimes you might have somebody covering for someone else because the independent living coordinator has left the agency. There are many instances where a verbal request for an appeal can be overlooked by the CBC. It's not supposed to be. There's rules in place that say they have to note it in the youth's file, but nonetheless, as we all know, having something in writing is far better than not having it in writing. If the basis of the appeal is a legal issue, an interpretation of the statute, for example, going back to the issue of whether being in a juvenile justice commitment facility on your 18th birthday qualifies you as being in the legal, although not physical, custody of DCF, that you really should go to a lawyer. And frankly, I think the lawyer should prepare the request for appeal. Many times the kids are advised, you only have 10 days to do this, you do your written request, and then they'll get to an attorney who may feel bound by the written request that the youth has made. Now, I never do. When I've had legal issues come up, even if the youth did the request, I'll file an amended petition for review so that I can set forth the basis that I want the hearing officer to act on, as well as setting the whole thing up for subsequent appeal if we lose. So you have 30 days within which to request the appeal. In the instance where the agency is terminating benefits or reducing benefits that the youth is already receiving, if the youth requests the appeal within 10 calendar days of the notice, then the youth continues to receive those benefits during the time that the procedure is pending. So if the youth feels relatively certain that they're going to win the appeal, or frankly, if they desperately need the money now rather than later, as long as they get their appeal request in within 10 calendar days, then they get continuing benefits. If they ultimately lose, then the agency will look for them to pay those benefits back. They're not going to go after the kids to pay it out of their own pockets, but if the kid subsequently applies for another program or reapplies for whatever they were terminated from, then the amount that they'll get is going to be reduced by some percentage until the CBC has been paid back for whatever the youth got pending that appeal. The other thing that has to happen is when the youth files a request for an appeal, within 3 days, the youth, or if the youth has used an attorney, they must get a complete copy of all of the documents that the agency relied on in making its decision on the benefit application. And that, of course, is important because how can you contest what an agency has done unless you see exactly how they reached their conclusion? And again, a lot of CBCs, at least in the past, when the rule was first adopted and implemented, there were CBCs that wouldn't want to do that, or they'd say, I can't do it in 3 days, we need more time, we'll let you come and see the file, but we're going to charge you for copies, all sorts of permutations on that. But the rule was very clear that that has to happen, and frankly, the youth doesn't even have to ask for it, they're supposed to be given it. There has to be an informal review that happens. So the youth, or if the youth has an attorney, the attorney or both of them have the option of going and having a meeting. I've done some of these meetings simply by conference call before, or you can go into the office. Even if the youth decides not to participate in the informal review, nonetheless, there has to be this informal review. And that's where a supervisor and the independent living coordinator, the person on the ground who made the calculations or made the initial decision, will go over with you what the basis is for your appeal. Now, usually if the basis is a legal issue, that's not going to get resolved. If it's a factual issue, that might very well get resolved. If you can show that you inputted the wrong amount here on line 5B, it should be this, and here's my documentation for saying it should be, you know, something other than what you put in. Those things usually get worked out. I've had timing things worked out, too. I had an instance where a youth had verbally given some information to the caseworker, and the caseworker, although he wrote it down, he forgot that he wrote it down in the file, and then the youth was denied for not getting certain information in timely, and so that was able to be resolved at the informal review level. If there is no resolution of the informal review, and that has to happen within 10 days after the agency gets the request for appeal, then it goes to a DCF hearing officer. Now, because these cases are confidential, because they're not tracked, there's nowhere online that you can go unless you drive to Tallahassee to see the progress of the appeal. So sometimes you'll wait a while to get something from the Auditor General's office telling you, or I'm sorry, it's Inspector General, not Auditor General, I apologize. You have to wait until somebody from the IG's office will contact you and tell you who the hearing officer is and when the hearing is scheduled. It's a very weird way of doing hearings. There's no motion to set. There's no hearing or telephonic way to set a hearing. So you may, if you're representing a youth, you may end up having to file a motion to reschedule the hearing because you're going to be on vacation that day, or the youth is scheduled for surgery that day, or having a final exam. So there are some real little glitches to representing someone in these hearings that are just because of the fact that they are heard by hearing officers. You should never have a problem with filing some sort of a motion with the hearing officer to try to reschedule or to get something done. There are procedural rules that govern the hearings. Now, there's two sets of procedural rules. All APA hearings are controlled by Chapter 28-106 of the Florida Administrative Code, and that includes these fair hearings. However, DCF has been permitted to adopt some of its own special rules. So if there is a special rule, that will control rather than the general 28-106 rule. So you do have that as a separate glitch. You need to look at both sets of rules and see which one, the general or the specific, is going to control. Discovery goes by the rules of civil procedure. If the agency will not provide you with discovery, you can file a motion with the hearing officer to request a ruling on the discovery. Some of the hearing officers don't see themselves in quite the quasi-judicial role that I see them in, and you won't get a ruling on the motion until you actually go to the hearing. Again, that's one of the little glitches, but you should not ask for discovery and not push it if the agency won't give it to you. In any event, I think that you should. One of the problems that I had was I was one time representing a young lady who was denied access to a program because the agency said it didn't have the money left in that fiscal year to give her any money, and I requested through discovery all of the financial records of the CBC, and they did not want me to look at them, and so they fought it and fought it and fought it. What was interesting was we finally resolved the case because they said, oh, we're wrong, we have money, and it was because it was a new fiscal year, and they now had some money, and so they cooked up another reason that she was denied. They still wouldn't resolve that one, though, but that made the hearing much easier. I think they realized that they were going to have to turn over the documents, and they just didn't want me to see them. Of course, what's somewhat ironic about that is because the CBCs are contractors of the department, the public records rules apply as well. So any one of us can look at any of the agency records that are not otherwise confidential. That is, we can't look at, you know, foster kids records unless they've been redacted, but we do have a right to look at all of their internal procedures and budgeting records and whatever by doing a public records request, but that's neither here nor there, I guess. You go to the hearing, it is recorded. It's not, there's no court reporter there. It simply is tape recorded. If it's a legal issue that you think will go up on further appeal, you might want to bring a court reporter there or advise the youth to spring for a court reporter to come to that fair hearing. Some odd things can happen in those hearings. Sometimes the hearing officer will call a little recess and go call his own office and ask how he should rule on a certain matter. So that's kind of interesting when that happens. When the hearing is over, you will usually get a certain amount of time within which to provide a proposed order. Always a good idea, obviously, just like it is in a court hearing. If a judge says, you give me your proposed order, you want to do it because you'll set forth all of the findings of fact that you want to have made as well as conclusions of law, and it makes it easier for a hearing officer to rule your way. Pay attention to the time frames, though. I've had an instance where the other side, the Attorney General's office, submitted their proposed order. They waited. I submitted mine on the last day, but the AG's office attorney decided she wasn't going to submit her proposed order until after she read mine. But since I submitted mine on the last day, she submitted hers outside of time, and the hearing officer said he did not consider hers for being submitted late. I think that that made an impact on the hearing officer of just how the whole hearing was conducted. It was quite interesting. Whatever the hearing officer does as their final decision, that's considered final agency action, and at that point, the youth can appeal the case to the District Court of Appeal. I'm in the First District anyway, so I've never sat down and tried to figure out where venue lies for filing these appeals. Because the department is the respondent, usually the appeals go to the First DCA anyway, I believe. But since the agency action occurs, I mean, it's very weird because, again, you have a local agency making decisions, but then the department is the one who sits as the respondent. So most likely all of these hearings, appellate cases, go up to the First District Court of Appeals. That leaves us a little less than 10 minutes for questions. So why don't we just stop now, and I'll take any questions you have.